Chapter 15. The man who played the disturbing part in The Two Quiet Lives Hereafter depicted no great man, in any sense, by the way first had knowledge of them on an October evening, in the city of Melchester. He had been standing in the close, vainly endeavoring to gain amid the darkness a glimpse of the most homogeneous pile of medieval architecture in England, which towered and tapered from the damp and level sward in front of him. While he stood, the presence of the cathedral walls was revealed rather by the ear than by the eyes. He could not see them, but they reflected sharply a roar of sound which entered the close by a street leading from the city square, and, falling upon the building, was flung back upon him. He postponed till the morrow his attempt to examine the deserted edifice, and turned his attention to the noise. It was compounded of steam barrel organs, the clanging of gongs, the ringing of hand bells, the clack of rattles, and the undistinguishable shouts of men. A lurid light hung in the air in the direction of the tumult. Thitherward he went, passing under the arched gateway, along a straight street, and into the square. He might have searched Europe over for a greater contrast between juxtaposed scenes. The spectacle was that of the eighth chasm of the Inferno, as to color and flame, and, as to mirth, a development of the Homeric heaven. A smoky glare, of the complexion of brass filings, ascended from the fiery tongues of innumerable naphtha lamps affixed to booths, stalls, and other temporary erections which crowded the spacious market square. In front of this irradiation, scores of human figures, more or less in profile, were darting athwart and across, up, down, and around, like gnats against a sunset. Their motions were so rhythmical that they seemed to be moved by machinery. And it presently appeared that they were moved by machinery indeed, the figures being those of the patrons of swings, seesaws, flying leaps, above all of the three steam roundabouts which occupied the center of the position. It was from the latter that the din of steam organs came. Throbbing humanity in full light was, on second thoughts, better than architecture in the dark. The young man, lighting a short pipe, and putting his hat on one side and one hand in his pocket, to throw himself into harmony with his new environment, drew near to the largest and most patronized of the steam circuses, as the roundabouts were called by their owners. This was one of brilliant finish, and it was now in full revolution. The musical instrument around which, and to whose tones the riders revolved, directed its trumpet mouths of brass upon the young man, and the long plate glass mirrors set at angles, which revolved with the machine, flashed the gyrating personages and hobby horses kaleidoscopically into his eyes. It could now be seen that he was unlike the majority of the crowd. A gentlemanly young fellow, one of the species found in large towns only, and London particularly, built on delicate lines, well, though not fashionably dressed, he appeared to belong to the professional class. He had nothing square or practical about his look, much that was curvilinear and sensuous. Indeed, some would have called him a man not altogether typical of the middle-class male of a century wherein sordid ambition is the master passion that seems to be taking the time-honored place of love. The revolving figures passed before his eyes with an unexpected and quiet grace in a throng whose natural movements did not suggest gracefulness or quietude as a rule. By some contrivance there was imparted to each of the hobby horses a motion which was really the triumph and perfection of roundabout inventiveness, a galloping rise and fall, so timed that, of each pair of steeds, one was on the spring, while the other was on the pitch. The riders were quite fascinated by these equine undulations in this most delightful holiday game of our times. There were riders as young as 6, and as old as 60 years, with every age between. At first it was difficult to catch a personality, but by and by the observer's eye centered on the prettiest girl out of the several pretty ones revolving. It was not that one with the light frock and light hat whom he had been at first attracted by. No, it was the one with the black cape, gray skirt, light gloves, and no, not even she, but the one behind her. She with the crimson skirt, dark jacket, brown hat, and brown gloves. Unmistakably, that was the prettiest girl. Having finally selected her, this idle spectator studied her as well as he was able during each of her brief transits across his visual field. She was absolutely unconscious of everything save the act of writing. Her features were wrapped in an ecstatic dreaminess. For the moment, she did not know her age, or her history or her lineaments, much less her troubles. He himself was full of vague latter-day glooms and popular melancholies, and it was a refreshing sensation to behold this young thing then and there, absolutely as happy as if she were in a paradise. Dreading the moment when the inexorable stoker, grimily lurking behind the glittering rococo work, should decide that this set of writers had had their pennyworth, and bring the whole concern of steam engine, horses, mirrors, trumpets, drums, cymbals, and such like to pause and silence, he waited for her every reappearance, glancing indifferently over the intervening forms, including the two plainer girls, the old woman and child, the two youngsters, the newly married couple, the old man with a clay pipe, the sparkish youth with a ring, the young ladies in the chariot, the pair of journeyman carpenters, and others, till his select country beauty followed on again in her place. He had never seen a fairer product of nature, and at each round she made a deeper mark in his sentiments. The stoppage then came, and the sighs of the riders were audible. He moved round to the place at which he reckoned she would alight, but she retained her seat. The empty saddles began to refill, and she plainly was deciding to have another turn. The young man drew up to the side of her steed, and pleasantly asked her if as he had enjoyed her ride. Oh yes. ... she said, with dancing eyes. It has been quite unlike anything I have ever felt in my life before. ... it was not difficult to fall into conversation with her. Unreserved to unreserved by nature, she was not experienced enough to be reserved by art, and after a little coaxing she answered his remarks readily. As he had come to live in Melchester from a village on the Great Plain, and this was the first time that as he had ever seen a steam circus, she could not understand how such wonderful machines were made. As he had come to the city on the invitation of Mrs. Harnham, who had taken her into her household, to train her as a servant, if she showed any aptitude. Mrs. Harnham was a young lady who, before she married, had been Miss Edith White, living in the country near the speaker's cottage. She was now very kind to her through knowing her in childhood so well. She was even taking the trouble to educate her. Mrs. Harnham was the only friend as he had in the world, and being without children had wished to have her near her in preference to anybody else, though as he had only lately come, allowed her to do almost as she liked, and to have a holiday whenever she asked for it. The husband of this kind young lady was a rich wine merchant of the town, but Mrs. Harnham did not care much about him. In the daytime you could see the house from where they were talking. She, the speaker, liked Melchester better than the lonely country, and she was going to have a new hat for next Sunday, that was to cost 15 and 9 pence. Then she inquired of her acquaintance where he lived, and he told her in London, that ancient and smoky city, where everybody lived who lived at all, and died because they could not live there. He came into Wessex 2 or 3 times a year for professional reasons. He had arrived from Wintoncester yesterday, and was going on into the next county in a day or two. For one thing, he did like the country better than the town, and it was because it contained such girls as herself. Then the pleasure machine started again, and, to the light-hearted girl, the figure of the handsome young man, the market square with its lights and crowd, the houses beyond, and the world at large, began moving round as before, counter-moving in the revolving mirrors on her right hand, she being as it were the fixed point in an undulating, dazzling, lurid universe, in which loomed forward most prominently of all the form of her late interlocutor. Each time that she approached the half of her orbit that lay nearest him, they gazed at each other with smiles, and with that unmistakable expression which means so little at the moment, yet so often leads up to passion, heartache, union, disunion, devotion, overpopulation, drudgery, content, resignation, despair. When the horses slowed anew, he stepped to her side and proposed another heat. "Hang the expense for once," apostrophe he said. "I'll pay." She laughed till the tears came. "Why do you laugh, dear?" Apostrophe said he. "Because you are so genteel, that you must have plenty of money, and only say that for fun." Apostrophe she returned. "Ha ha!" Apostrophe laughed the young man in unison, and gallantly producing his money she was enabled to whirl on again. As he stood smiling there in the motley crowd, with his pipe in his hand, and clad in the rough pea jacket and widowick that he had put on for his stroll, who would have supposed him to be Charles Bradford Ray Esquire, stuff gownsman, educated at Wintoncester, called to the bar at Lincoln's Inn, now going the Western Circuit, merely detained in Melchester by a small arbitration after his brethren had moved on to the next county town? Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.